I'm thinking this thing doesn't take credit cards.
Sign says closed.
We're looking for, what's it called?
Tillerman Road.
Not to get you there. Getting back. That's your concern.
The lambs have passed through the gate. They are come to the killing floor.
Let's get this party started!
I seriously believe something weird is going on.
Welcome to Split Cinema. We wanted to kick off Halloween right and, watch a film that some people might consider a horror movie, some people might consider a comedy. Regardless, we have Lena Riggs joining us from Let's Scare Lena.
Hello.
Check out her blog, check out her her Instagram, where she watches Halloween horror movies, classic ones, all the way to modern horror movies, and kind of talks about them. And so this was your first time watching Cabin in the Woods, correct?
Yes. I did not know what to expect.
And you had no idea?
None. Nope. Okay. I had been told it wasn't really a horror movie. And about like 2 minutes in, I go, oh, this is a Joss Whedon movie.
And Matt, had you seen it before? Is this your first time?
This is like my third or fourth time.
Oh, wow. Okay, so you're a veteran. So this was my second time. I watched it. So it's kind of great. It was kind of a great mix. You know, I'd seen it once back in the day. You've seen it a lot. Lena hadn't seen it before. And so this will be interesting. I didn't like it the first time I saw it, which was years ago. I think it's because I had the expectation that it was going to be more of a horror film. Because no one told me anything. So I was like, oh, it's a scary movie. And I watched it on Halloween. And I was disappointed. I was like, this is corny and it's campy. Watching it again, I really enjoyed it. I don't know if it's because I knew it was coming. And again, I didn't know specifics. I don't remember that. I knew the general story and what the twist is. Mm-hmm. But I really enjoyed it, knowing that it was kind of a parody.
Right. You were one of the angry gods the first time around. You were not sacrificed.
Not satisfied with the sacrifices. Kill the virgin. Like, what the heck? So, Lena, what are your initial thoughts on it?
I was really confused for like the first half of the movie. I couldn't quite tell what was going on. I'm like, are people like paying in to watch this? And is there some like dark web thing going on? And it was too lighthearted and obviously too Whedon-esque to be too dark. But I really got into it once I realized that all the corporate ties were going to get theirs. That was was a turning point.
It's always the good part of a movie.
I screamed with laughter when the unicorn impaled that man. I just peak horror experience right there. I loved it.
Yeah, I really like this movie. And I think part of the reason is like, the whole, how it deconstructs the horror genre. I mean, that's obviously what it's doing. But I just enjoy that. It's just such a fun like game of a movie. So I first watched it around the time it came out, and then I hadn't seen it until very recently. I think I watched it like twice now in a row. And I forgot, my memory of it was that you don't know there's like this underground, suits pulling the strings. I thought that was revealed later on. I completely forgot that's right at the beginning. So I like how they layered it in. Because in another, like, I was thinking this would be a pretty good M. Night Shyamalan movie. Like, he could do the story, but his version, you wouldn't know about the people pulling the strings until the very end. And then it probably wouldn't work because it would be too much of a reveal. So I thought it was really interesting how they layered it in. You have that one guy, his name is Truman, I guess, who's sort of the person to whom they explain the rules of, like, what they're doing and how, Anyway, so I enjoyed how they layered all that in.
I always forget what it's called.
Like an audience surrogate or exposition, yeah.
Exposition.
Yeah. There was they layered it in nicely, yeah.
Yeah, and his name is Truman for a reason.
like Truman Show. Oh, interesting.
Oh, that's a good, oh, wow. What a great, find. Nice. So Matt, yeah, before we get too deep into it, do you want to give a summary of the film?
Sure. Yeah. I feel like I'm never succinct enough of these, but I mean, it's called The Cabin in the Woods. It's already playing off kind of horror tropes. It's a group of college kids who we find out are later, they're not picked to be, they devolve into certain archetypes in the horror genre. The jock, I don't know, I guess the virgin, the slut, right? The stoner, and then the scholar. Whore. The whore, is that the name? That they whore. Use? Mm-hmm. But then the scholar, I never really remember the scholar being one of them, but apparently it is.
Right, I feel like scholar was, yeah,
he is like the wizard, right? It's the sage. It's the, that's the same general archetype.
Hmm. Well, so it's these five of them. And then they head off to a cabin in the woods pretty early on. I mean, right away, we know someone's pulling the strings. And then you start to learn more and more how they're kind of entering a labyrinth in which it's kind of like the movie Saw, I guess, in a way, or at least that the puzzle nature of it. And there is some demonic or some godly force behind the scenes to whom the suits pulling the strings are subservient. And so we kind of discover that these five college students are sacrifices in some way. And then, but how they die ultimately is up to them. And then, you know, the game is uncovered and breaks down. And that's the gist of the movie. Do you think, did I leave anything out?
No, I think it's a great summary. It's actually a pretty simple story. Mm-hmm. But it's just, yeah, I mean, you said it reminds you of Saw. It reminds me of Hunger Games. Mm-hmm. And I actually wrote down all the things that reminded me of the Hunger Games. The actress who plays the Virgin, she sounds like Jennifer Lawrence. Like if you just heard her talk, you would think it was Jennifer Lawrence. They sound very similar. Mm-hmm. The shield that Chris Hemsworth hits that shows like the boundary of the cabin in the woods realm, mm-hmm, very similar to Hunger Games. The manipulation of life and death obviously is a huge theme. And then the voiceover, like at the end when Madame Sigourney comes up over the loudspeaker and starts talking to them, it was very, very similar to Hunger Games. And I believe it was, Hunger Games came out a year or two before.
It was around the same time, around like 2012. Maybe when the book was out before.
Yeah, but the movie is what I found similar. Obviously the themes of, you know, life and death, but the movie is, oh yeah, it came out in 2012. That's super interesting because this came out in 2011.
I think it was released in 2012. It was just, sometimes the IMDb dates are weird because it might have been released like in a few theaters in 2011, but I definitely remember it coming out in 2012, like the spring, right around the time of Avengers.
So that's interesting. So I wonder if we dug a little bit deeper, we'd find similar like cinematographers or something or special effects people. Cause like the shield almost, I mean, the Catching Fire is when you see the shield, the second Hunger Games film, which doesn't come out till way later. It's almost the exact same. Like the way it lights up. So I just noticed that it was kind of cool. So Lena, I have to ask you, since you've been watching a lot of horror movies, can you think of, I mean, we know that this whole idea of the whore, the scholar is kind of a repetitive theme across other horror movies. Do you know of any off the top of your head?
I mean, the biggest one that it reminded me of was Scooby-Doo. That's the Spooky Game. That's Velma's the scholar. Daphne is probably the whore, right?
Yes.
Shaggy's the fool. You know, it's.
And like the fool in the cabin in the woods kind of looks like Shaggy.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that was the Scooby Gang. But with Jesse Williams instead of a dog. No, there were a lot of similarities. Like The Last Girl is the biggest one, right? We see that in Halloween and Friday the 13th, mm-hmm, and Texas Chainsaw Massacre. There were so many nods to Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It was ridiculous. But I think that the overall structure of it, and even just those archetypes, we don't just see it in horror, but we demand it in horror. we see them in other films, like you mentioned with Hunger Games, but it's not just where those archetypes live. It's just that they die for very strict rules within horror.
That's interesting. Halloween created a lot of these tropes, if I'm not mistaken. Granted, I don't want to pretend I'm the most, I know the most about horror movies, but it, you know, Jamie Lee Curtis, and then she kind of played that role again in like what, Prom Night, and a whole bunch of other movies. Mm-hmm. And then, Lena. So do you think, was Halloween sort of the template for a lot of this?
It's the most clear cut, I would say. Halloween, and then, you know, quickly followed by Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street. They definitely went off of the Halloween clear cut. But I think this theme of a woman surviving, frankly, the audacity of really scary men, we've seen that in horror since Phantom of the Opera, right? We've seen that since Nosferatu in the 20s with the silent films. This idea of femininity having to be preserved and being this dual preciousness of both the whore and the virgin, that's been common in horror since forever, right? In King Kong, right? It's the beauty that tames the beast because she's the virgin beauty that has to be saved. And in the course of horror movie history, we do see first the infantilization of women, and then they kind of come into their own power. And it's interesting because it always corresponds with whatever's happening politically and in the world, right? They have some kind of autonomy and authority, and they become more complex in the 30s. But then when we get back into the 40s and 50s, that last girl is already there. She's just portrayed more as the partner. You know, she's trying to survive in Psycho. She's trying to survive her daughter.
The Shining.
Yeah. She's trying to survive her daughter in The Bad Seed, right? We've already, I think in horror, there's this fascination with the creation of life. And that's something that women have the ability to create. And I think that's a lot of the core frustrations that we see, not only from the director's point of view, which are usually male, but also the creature, the threat, the monster, whoever it is coming after a woman. And that's what makes it terrible and scary. That's what made it sad in Exorcist, right? The poor little girl possessed by a demon. And the only reason she's possessed by a demon is because some dude went digging in the desert where he wasn't supposed to. The last girl trope is just an evolution of that.
Yeah, and that's interesting that you say, like, they prey on women, especially because women can give life, and you think of movies like Rosemary's Baby, mm-hmm. where that's the whole arc of the story, is that she births the devil. Right. And you do see that theme, especially when children are involved. And, it's so interesting. I remember you and I, Lena, were talking about a while ago, why this idea of the virgin is sacred to horror. And I actually didn't look this up, but I remember you telling me that it's from, you know, kind of Puritan culture, and showing that, you know, if you preserve yourself, you won't get murdered by the scary man.
Right. Yeah. It comes down to not just the commodification, but the preservation of virginity as being the most important thing for a woman. Try as they may, most horror movies just reinforce that idea. I would say Carnival of Souls and Night of the Living Dead are the exceptions, where they don't really focus on her sexuality. They don't really focus on whether or not she's a mother. She's not classified in what she's doing in her bed or what she's doing with her body or what she's doing as a mother. It's only just about the circumstance that this character is in. And it really could be a gender neutral role for both female leads in those movies. But all of the other ones, it's about sex at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Horror is a lot of sexual frustration at the end of the day. That's what it is.
Something I wish, now that we talk about it, I wish it kind of dug a little bit deeper into why these different archetypes were chosen for sacrifice. And so I wish it kind of, I know it was kind of a parody on horror film, but I think it could have kind of talked about, okay, why is the virgin optional? Why does she not need to die? I kind of wish they would have given a little bit more context or given their perspective on it. I think that could have added a layer of, oh, that's interesting, you know?
Yeah. Well, and she wasn't even a virgin.
Well, that was the thing, right? Is none of them were the thing they were designed to be. They became that thing. Even Jules, like, we learned that the blonde, that's not her natural hair color. She just got it. We learned that is an academic on academic scholarship.
Philosophy, or sociology or something. Yeah.
And so Kristen Connolly's actress, Dana, and she and Jesse, they're making out on the couch, and she pulls away and she says, "I never," and then she's like, "Wait, no, that's not true." Because she had the relationship with her professor, they allude to at the beginning. But so she's like, whatever chemicals they're pumping into this cabin, it's forcing them into the stereotype, like the archetype or stereotype. Mm-hmm.
I would say my biggest qualm with the chemicals was that the weed made him immune. You would think that ancient beings with thousands of years of experience doing this would have found a way around weed.
By now.
Right? This is their first stoner fool. I don't buy it.
The ancient beings aren't the ones. It's like the ancient beings just want blood, right? It's the humans, the suits. They've constructed the game through which we.
So they don't go into that, which I would have liked that. I would have liked to get a little bit more information on how they decided on the different personas. Like, was that the ancient beings, or was that
they could
it was. Yeah.
They could do a sequel that's, you know, really a prequel to Cabin in the Woods 1950, or like, you know, what was it like in 1950? Because they're already dressed like it's 1950, and you know, the white shirts and black ties, and
they could totally do a prequel. Yeah.
They could go deeper in a lot of this, but there's so much like exposition, and there's so much, I think there are so many games within the game that they want to kind of show off, including like, oh, they're gambling on what's going to happen, and here's all the different monsters or, you know, creatures who could get them. And there's almost so many things they want to throw in here, which I think is what makes it, to me, rewatchable. You're like, I don't know, there's a lot. It's pretty dense in a good way. That it's like they can't really go deeper into the story, maybe? Or that's how it felt to me.
Yeah.
Like, there's just so much. You just tell the story. It's kind of satire. And we just kind of, it moves very quickly, right? It motors right on through.
It's kind of like what you say. I love this term Matt always says with movies. They play flat, fast, and loose with just get on with the story. Like, those details aren't really needed, and they're not. I mean, it would be nice, but they're not needed. Like, what matters is we want to see the hero win in the end. And
so. And this, sorry, Lena, go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to say, by doing that, they fall into their own trope of itself, right? Like, that is a horror movie trope, to just blow right past the details.
Glaze over the details.
We got a plot to see. We've got blood to see. There's, you know, someone's half naked and dying.
We got limbs to cut off.
Right. Yeah. Right. We have a virgin to sacrifice, people. Let's move it along here.
Yeah. I think what, from like a storytelling standpoint and just keeping the rhythms of the movie going, because this feels, you know, it's a studio movie. It feels like it was audience tested to some extent. Like it's because it like kind of you alluded to, Lena, like it's describing how we have this sort of bloodlust. We demand these things as a viewer, and then it's also giving you those things. Like, it's very meta, but it's also just still doing it, you know, kind of shamelessly, I suppose. But because they established right away the people behind the scenes, and some screenwriting podcast or something I was reading or watching, they talked about if you want to keep a story moving and you don't know how to get from here to here with these characters, you can always say, like, meanwhile, back on the farm or something. So basically cut to someone else when you return to the characters, they're in the next thing. And it just kind of keeps the story moving. And so in this case, it's like we see them arrive at the cabin. They kind of get spooked by the mirror and just seeing everything in the house. And then we just cut back to the people pulling the strings. And when we return to our five sort of heroes, now they're at the lake. And then we cut back to the people and the like, you know, the I mean, what do you call it? The, whatever facility they're in, when you cut back to the
corporate America.
Yeah. When you cut back to the five college students, now they're drinking and they're playing Truth or Dare. And so it just very quickly goes back and forth, like, but it just kind of keeps it moving. And if the point is to be entertaining and, you know, to like just keep going, I think that was a good little trick. Yeah, I think it's just a well-written screenplay. It's very economical.
And I love the humor, because there's some points when you're like, this is not funny anymore. Like, this is terrifying and like gross, and this has turned into a horror movie. And then they cut to them partying and celebrating because the virgin is getting killed on a dock, and the music. I watched that scene. I was trying to look up what song's playing. I watched that scene four times. I like just the zoom out from like the zombie just killing her on the dock and the music playing and everyone's cheersing. It was so beautifully horrific. and I thought that was just so well done. And like, and then just that, and then also the poetic justice of him wanting the sea monster. He really, really wanted the sea monster, and then he ends up getting killed by the sea monster. I was just like, this is so just horrible and just sick, but kind of awesome.
I love that too. Also, sorry, kind of backtracking for a second. Because it's sort of meta and it's commenting on horror movies, it reminded me a little of Get Out. And you know, the title Get Out is literally kind of telling you what, how people react to like, get out of that house. Like they're, it's sort of addressing the, how the audience factors into this. And I was thinking about how Get Out had, you know, sort of a character arc for the main character and maybe some of the depth that other horror movies have not historically had. And these characters, they really don't have much depth, but once they enter the labyrinth, it's like it doesn't matter who they were, because now they are only the you know, the things mm-hmm. that define them are within the game. You know, they are only the virgin, they're only the jock, you know, the fool. And so I thought that was interesting. It's like, it really is just like, it's like, you know, they made Clue into a movie. Like, you just, it's just a game of a movie. But that's kind of fun to watch.
It almost makes it kind of easy, because you play off this, the cheap ideas from other horror films of, okay, we're going to have a whore, a fool, an athlete. Like, they play in these stereotypes, which makes it pretty easy. And then the rest of the film is where they can get creative. Like, okay, we're going to, and what do we title it? I don't know, Cabin in the Woods? Like, something so stereotypical. They just kind of follow under the stereotypes for the whole film. But then weave in this, the idea of puppeteers.
They wrote a movie about themselves writing a horror movie. So that the two director guys in suits are supposed to be the two directors. That's supposed to be Whedon and what's his face?
Goddard, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's supposed to be them. And it's them answering to all of us ridiculous, angry ancient monsters demanding the blood and the guts and the virgin and the whores.
No, yeah, it's great. Yeah, and it's like one of the other movies we did an episode on was Inception, which has a similar kind of like undercurrent, or it's like each character, like Leo DiCaprio in that movie could be seen as the director, Joseph Gordon-Levitt could be seen as the producer, the writer. And so it has sort of the not the theme, but you know, that's like a defining framework for the film. It is the filmmaking within the film.
I love it when writers write themselves in.
Well, I like to think who is
not narcissistic at all.
No, not a hint of narcissism. Just a multi-million-dollar movie about an idea that you had.
I like to think, like, who is Truman like representing when they're writing the movie? They have someone who's just like, why are you doing that to that poor woman? It's like, you don't understand how horror movies work. This has to happen. So it's like, that's a stand-in for one of them has like a 10-year-old nephew, and they're just explaining the rules of horror movies. This has to happen. You don't get it. This is what we need.
You don't get it. This is Hollywood.
First time.
Can we talk about the whole Japanese storyline? And all the racist remarks in this film? Like, okay, I wrote it down. Everyone knows you can't trust the Swedes. That's one of like, that's like the fifth line in the movie. And you're out at the bat, you're like, what? And then the Japanese, they say something like, what are they going to do with all that free time? They're not relaxed. It was just like, I don't know why that was in there. I mean, maybe because, yeah, go for it.
I think it was a nod to Japanese horror films. None of the monsters in this movie are accidental. You know, they can all be tied back to another film. And Japanese mm-hmm. horror is just such a massive, you know, massive imprint on the industry. And even just with the character that they had, you know, terrorizing the schoolgirls and the way that it was defeated is just so stereotypical for those films. While, yes, they played off of some stereotypes that are not appropriate and are not okay, they, I think they meant it as an homage. They just...
Mm-hmm.
I love that.
They thought
the
whole movie was an homage, but I mean, Joss Whedon's never been, you know, self-aware.
It just, that part just made me think of like movies like The Ring, you know,
or The Grudge.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly. And so I thought that was hilarious. Just like how they, you know, they show the one shot of that floating girl terror and she looks terrifying. You know, she's scaring a classroom full of girls. I think everyone in that classroom was a girl, which is interesting. And then like the next time you cut to them, they've like tamed the monster, you know, they're just singing. Like, I thought that was great. And there was that one line where they say like whoever the people are in Japan who are pulling the strings, they've never failed. And so this is the first time they failed. That's actually one of my very small nitpicks was this has worked for every year for all of eternity. This has worked. And then, so this time everyone happens to fail on the same day. And then, like, it's just so much. I mean, of course, that's the movie, right? Like, if you don't have that, you don't have a movie. But I just thought that was kind
of funny.
And
that's a movie cliche in and of itself.
Right. Wait, didn't they say they've never pulled it off? They say later they've never been able to pull it off.
The sacrifice? I mean, they always pull off the sacrifice.
Maybe it was a certain type of creature that they rarely use. I don't know.
Oh, maybe the redneck zombies. I don't know. They said something later that was confusing. I should have wrote it down, but it was something like they've never pulled it off before.
They said the redneck zombie torture family has perfect record. They did say that.
Yeah. Oh, gotcha. Okay, I have a question. Again, skipping. I have a couple questions actually. My first one is at the very end when. One of the corporate guys, I don't know his name, but the actor from Step Brothers, is dying and the virgin shot him she killed him or she stabbed him. And she's looking at him and he goes, kill him. Did he mean the fool?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. I thought he meant the monster. And cause I haven't seen this in years. So I'm like, I didn't remember how it ended. So I was like, oh, she means kill the monster guy, the ancient guy. Mm. But no, she meant the fool.
Right, okay. Right. Because then the ritual would be complete and the world would be
right.
Safe. Yeah, he's a good company man, you know? He just wants to do what's right for the company.
Just wants to save the world.
Yeah.
Torturing innocence. Who doesn't?
All right, so I don't figure out what to go to next. As putting aside all the behind the scenes stuff, I thought this was completely fine as just a Cabin in the Woods horror movie. Like, there were jump scares. Like, I'm not a big jump scare person. I don't like being startled, but I was like, this is perfectly fine as like you know, I thought it was entertaining. It was all very silly, but I don't know, I kind of enjoyed even just that part of it. Like, it was just it did the beats well, right? I mean, you have the kind of just the slow build of the music, the creepy yada yada, the jumps, the startling. I don't know. I just thought like that part easily could have fallen short. Maybe some people did, but I was like, even that part, I was like, yeah, it's well made. It works.
Yeah, no, they had a formula and they ticked off all of the boxes.
Another stereotype I wrote down in my notes that cracked me up was when Mordecai, the gas station guy, he goes, been here since the war. And Jules goes, what war? And he goes, you know damn well what war. I was like, so good. Because in every horror film, there's always an old guy who's been there since the war and never talks. You're like, what year is this? What war was that?
Yeah, no, the Harbinger, his whole thing, I loved it. It from them walking into a space that wasn't theirs, which by the way is another horror trope and I can't stand it. I lose my shit every time. Can I curse?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. I lose my shit every time whenever someone touches something that isn't theirs in a horror film. It's like, this is your comeuppance.
Are you talking about when they go down to the cellar?
That, and even just when he walks into the store when it says closed.
Oh.
It says closed. They made it a point to show us the closed sign and he walks in uninvited.
Is it the trespassing that bothers you or is it the stupidity bothers you?
It's both. It's the, that's not yours, put it away. This is not your space. You're not entitled to it, which is an act of violence, right? Like that is what monsters and horror movies do is they invade someone or invade their space by taking their life or taking their head or their arm, whatever it may be. And you always see one of the characters at least do that to an item, an object. And it's like, that's just a direct tie back to how these monsters see people as objects. But he walks right into the store, Harbinger scares him, great classic jump. And then the speakerphone scene.
Yeah.
Yeah. Perfect. Cause he's trying to warn both, right? That's what Harbinger is. They're a warning sign. And the kids ignored him and everybody back at headquarters ignored him too.
No, that's actually a really good point about that, the second level of the Harbinger.
Did anyone notice Chris Hemsworth's accent going in and out?
Oh my God.
It was bad. It was bad. I kept hearing. I was like, dude, you got it.
Honestly, I never did. I never noticed it.
Before he got an actual good, vocal coach, this was pre-money, Chris.
No, it's funny because I just watched the Jurassic movies that made us on Jurassic Park on Netflix. I don't know if y'all seen it, but Sam Neill, who's from Australia or New Zealand, he talks about how Steven Spielberg was like, I want you to be American. And so he's like, okay. So he does his American voice and and then he's like, no, go back. Just do Australia, just do New Zealand. He's like, okay. And so he does it. And then Steven Spielberg tells him, actually, can you do something in the middle? So if you watch Jurassic Park, so Sam Neill actually says in an interview, now everyone just thinks I have a horrible American accent because I was asked to do something in between. So I wonder if Chris Hemsworth, they were like, turn on the Australian a little bit, but just to a four, you know?
Get the Australian pheromones pumped in.
Yeah, yeah.
Going back to the whole taking what's not yours or going somewhere you're not supposed to be. That's almost sort of like the Garden of Eden, right? To make it biblical, because there are biblical undertones. And one of the ideas mm-hmm. of the final girl or the virgin is at least one of the theories, and maybe this was maybe not debunked, but it wasn't as conscious as people thought it was. Or maybe it was, I don't know. But that these things all go back to religious, religious
mm-hmm.
whatever. And when I think the first girl dies, or when the first person dies, we do see Richard Jenkins, he's one of the guys behind the control board. He does do a little prayer, right? He says a prayer. And so it's just one more little biblical thing. And then the fact that gods are behind all of this in some way,
Well, and then to snowball off of that, take what's not yours, you have the two-way mirror, which is you see what you're not supposed to see. I actually did a little deep dive on a two-way mirror because I was super curious, is that normal, to be in a house? I mean, obviously not, but has that, kind of what is the history behind it? And I just, so it works because glass is coated with a thin, transparent layer of metal, and the result is a mirrored surface that reflects light. And light always passes equally in both directions. However, when one side is brightly lit and the other kept dark, the darker side becomes difficult to see from the brightly lit side because it's masked by a much brighter reflection. And so it's used in execution chambers, experimental psychology, interrogation rooms, market research, observation decks. And this is kind of interesting. So I was reading that, there's a way to detect a one-way mirror from a two-way mirror. And I guess you And Matt, you can remove this or not, I don't care. But I just thought this was really interesting because I always kind of freak out about that when I'm in like Airbnbs or hotel rooms and stuff. So you place the tip of your fingernail against the reflective surface. And if there is a gap between your fingernail and the image of the nail, then it is a genuine mirror. If your fingernail directly touches the image of the nail, then beware, for it is a two-way mirror, and get the fuck out of there.
That's interesting.
It also stated you could further discern the nature of the suspect surface by hurling an object like a chair at it, because the chair will go right through, obviously. So I just thought that was interesting because, you know, I was like, two-way mirrors, like, it just freaks me out, the whole idea behind someone watching you. And, you know, obviously that's a very, very traditional horror movie trope, you know, in Halloween and Friday the 13th, where you actually never see the villain. You watch a lot of the murder and his, you know, killing through his eyes. You see it through his eyes. You never actually see him. And so I thought that was kind of interesting.
Was there a purpose to the mirror within the story, not just like thematically, but like, was it going to somehow factor in with, do you think, with one of the scenarios? Because
I think that was a former observation room.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Hmm.
So before all the tech, I think that was their observation room. And then the downstairs was the torture cellar, because that's where they did the sacrifice. So it was crude, right? It's evolved over time. They've gotten better at ways to do the ritual.
It's interesting that they would still have it.
I didn't get that at all, but that's a very interesting take, because I thought it was a part of the family. But that would make sense because he sees that painting.
Mm-hmm. And that painting had a nod to Slender. Yeah.
The painting where it shows the goat like slashed, his head cut off, and shows the sacrificial goat, mm-hmm, or lamb.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Oh, that's, yeah, no, I think you're totally right, because yeah, no, that makes sense.
That is interesting. Yeah, I'd like to know more about how they pull this off. But I do like those little nods to the, you know, because you don't have to explain everything, but just those little details are definitely pretty intriguing. I mean, also the fact
that... You want the logistics breakdown.
Well, no, it's just nice seeing the texture, right? You could, like, things like that are considered. And, like, the you know, all the people behind the scenes, there's a clear hierarchy. There, it's, like, very... It's clearly underground, we know that. But it's, like, everything is gray and, like, kind of oppressive. And that was a choice, right? To show, like, what does this world look like? That's the cabin part is, like, has... You know, we know what that's supposed to look like. That's commenting on what we've already experienced. But this part, it's like they're that's where they make, I guess, more of a choice. Like, what would this hypothetical made up world look like? And if it's really playing on, you know, it is playing on filmmakers, writers, all that stuff, directors, then wouldn't they be in some posh like Beverly Hills? They wouldn't be.
I think it plays more on corporate America and like like, because when I first saw it, I probably had I was, you know, in college, I didn't work, you know, really full-time anywhere. But now, like, that I work in tech and I've worked in an office, and a lot of the guy asking the girl out and her just walking away and the asking for OT and stuff, like, you kind of, I think that gives a way for the audience to really relate and be like, oh, this is funny. Because, I mean, you look at movies like Office Space. The corporate America is supposed to be very dull, very boring, unexciting work. And then here they're literally sacrificing people on a giant screen. And meanwhile, you know, celebrating in red Solo cups in an office floor. And it's just like this mixture of cultures. And I kind of found myself like not able to process it, like kind of jumping, like, okay. Like, cause it is like horror, but it's also just not two sets you don't normally see together.
Yeah. And I got the corporate pickup for me, I think because of my background, I also got theme park, heavy, heavy theme park. Like that felt like Jurassic Park, all the control room scenes in Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
That's that right there. You know, I, once they caught back into the the underground, and they were, I think they were watching her die. That was right when I was thinking, oh my gosh, why isn't this a haunted house at Universal? This would be perfect. We already have the sound stages. You could just borrow the chairs from HR because it looks exactly like that.
That's a good point. And then that the first scene, you know, it's when we start down there, it plays on the monotonous, just like the grays, whites, mm-hmm. blacks mm-hmm. of the environment, because then it does the title in all red, you know, it's supposed to stand out. So that's like, I guess that speaks to the same idea, that juxtaposition of, yeah, I don't know, that is
pretty. Yeah, when they're driving that cart under the tunnels, that reminded me of Magic Kingdom. All the tunnels stuff. Underneath.
What do you think about this idea? Because they mention free will. So they have certain rules, right? It has to be the certain stereotypes. And they pick their villain, their monster. They have to transgress. So he says that he has a line that's something like, if they don't transgress, they won't be punished. Mm-hmm. What are like your thoughts on that, and how free will comes into play, and also how we see that through horror film history?
Going back to the Bible stuff, isn't it? It's like, it's kind of basically saying it's our, in our nature to do these things. Like I don't know if this is very Catholic or something, but like when you go to confession, or you go to confession for a reason, right? Because you were, I don't know, I'm not Catholic, really. I don't know what I am, but. I was baptized something, but it's a long time ago. But it's like that's in our nature to do these things, that like to cross and the thing, like the Garden of Eden. Yeah, it's like
but
we just can't help it, right?
I feel
we deserve to be punished.
But I feel like the different archetypes though don't really sin. They don't do anything. Like the horror, obviously, like we know that one, but like the fool, the athlete, the jock, I guess you can say the fool is smoking weed, which is illegal, but like the athlete and the scholar, I don't really know why they are punished when they haven't transgressed. Bueller, anything?
I don't know. I mean, yeah, I just thought that, saw that. I was like, that was the template that we're making fun of.
Yeah, I think it's just the horror that has to transgress. Because again, we're here to punish women for having sex.
Yeah, I know. I just, I'm very big, Matt knows this, I'm very big on rules. And like when a movie sets rules, I'm like, okay, they have to follow them. And it bothers me when they don't follow them, which is why Inception was a big matzo ball for me. But this one, it says if they don't transgress, they won't be punished. And there needs to be free will in order for the game to work. So, was there free will choosing the villain, or was it driving to the cabin? Like, what was that act of free will that kind of unlocked, okay, they're in?
All of it, right? Because they even said, like, they chose to ignore the Harbinger. And so I think mm-hmm. all of it. I mean, I don't know how they were selected, because I think Kurt, right? I think the Chris Hemsworth character, he says it's his cousin's cabin. Something. So
yeah, and she dyed her hair before they left, which they said they had put something in her hair dye. So mm-hmm. I was like, wait, when did you guys gain control over these characters?
Way back when they, you know, when Kurt apparently started to believe he had a cousin, because Dana at one point says, I don't even think Kurt has a cousin.
Yeah, was that like supposed to be like, I was just a little, it was a little foggy for me, kind of where the lines were a little bit blurred for me on that. I would have liked more precise, like when they said this, or when they did this, or something that was like the green light, like they're the ones.
Yeah, I don't think they all needed to transgress. I think it was just the whore, because that's what makes her a whore.
I think they should have transgressed. I think they all should have transgressed, like done something. And it could have been fed into them. Like the scholar, he could have said something to the virgin. I say this because I don't know their character names. He could have said something to her that was offensive or something that like totally was just, because they were feeding them these these ideas and behaviors. And so I think that would have been totally on track to have him do something that would just be against his character and show that, okay, he's needs to be punished now. I don't know. I think that would have been really easy to do. Because they made a big deal out of the whore. They made a big deal out of Jules kind of making out with the wolf and sexy dancing in front of the fire. Like, they made a huge deal. Like, we get it. Okay, she's going to take her clothes off. We get it. But those like, were, those were both they kind of glazed over.
Those were both nods back to other movies, though.
Which movies?
Evil Dead. I was reading an Easter egg. I'm forgetting what the other one was. And then they directly quote X-Files in that same scene. I think a lot of some of the oddities that they worked in were their way of just paying homage. Because it's a love letter to horror movies while also being a, we hate this about horror movies. It's a critique.
Well, it's a parody. It's a script. Right.
So apparently the script was written by Drew Goddard and Joss Whedon. Joss Whedon in 3 days, allegedly. I don't know if I believe that exactly. But if it was, it would kind of explain why a lot of these things are in there. Is like they've watched horror movies. They've probably written them. Like, they know it so well. They can just kind of churn it out. Like, they, you know. But that also means maybe some of the stuff is only in there because it was in other movies. It's not like there isn't so much more added depth.
That would have been actually funny to put in. Like, if the Truman goes, like, well, why? And they're like,
just
the way it is. Like, that would have been really funny, because it shows how directors and writers for horror sometimes glaze over the details and kind of don't think outside the box and just do how we continuously just do stuff just because that's the way it's been done, and that's what gets butts in the seats. So I always think that would have been funny, like, for him to continuously, but why? I don't know. Like,
also, you know, what do you think the that whole team of people they do the rest of the year? Is it just setting this all up? Like, this is their big, you know, this is their Super Bowl, right? Because this is such a huge deal. So they spend the whole year, like, putting the leaves in the right place, or, you know, making sure there's the right amount of dust in the cellar. Like, what
the antithesis? It's like the antithesis of Christmas.
You get one show a year. I hope they get at least 2 weeks vacation.
Yeah, you gotta relax.
I gotta imagine the PTO is pretty good.
Right? Good health benefits.
I have one question about the ending. Like, I mean, so the ending is obviously the end of the world. What are your thoughts? Any alternate endings that you think would have been good? Anything?
Unless she decides to kill Marty.
That's what I thought happened. I thought she killed Marty and she saved the world. I honestly didn't remember the ending. And so when I saw that ending, I was like, oh, I don't remember that at all.
I thought it was really refreshing that she didn't save the world. Like, really refreshing.
I guess that's the point, right? That actually is the theme. Like, they talk about very early on when they're in the camper van driving, Marty says, like, for once, can't we just, like, get off our phones, get off the grid? And then he talks about civilization and how civilization just fills in the cracks with cement, and I forget the exact words, but he's like, you know, civilization will erode, and it's like we have to let it. And then, like, this time when I watched that, I was like, oh yeah, that's because that's how it ends. And there's another line in there, I think, about that. And then, yeah, so that's sort of, I guess that is their mission statement, is like, we have this, like, I don't know, insatiable need for, I don't even know what it is exactly, but it's like, yeah, you know, maybe it's time we just, like, let it go and give some other species or something a try.
I think it was a critique on horror films, because we were starting to see, like, you know, another Halloween film, another Friday the 13th at that time, rather than people thinking out of the box and doing horror in a different way. I think it was their plea to say, like, let's let the monsters win. Let's break the script. Let's not follow the ritual every single time. I got serious History of the World Part 2 vibes when they were just sitting there smoking. Reminded me of the end of that movie where the Roman soldiers are just kind of watching Rome burn and going, all right, man, I guess this is what we're doing now.
Okay, one final question. What would be your worst nightmare? What would be the villain or the monster creature that you would not want to face?
Anything that kills you slowly.
Okay, what would that be? Like something eating you?
I don't remember. I mean, what was the one that Bradley Whitford's character that he kept obsessing over that it finally killed him?
The sea monster.
There's a man. Merman. I did love the way the blood spurted out. That was a great touch. Yeah. Also, random comment, Bradley Whitford, I feel like he doesn't look like Bradley Whitford in this movie anymore. Now he has the white hair and a white beard. He's in Get Out. He's in just like a bunch of really mm-hmm. good, somewhat small, but like well-received movies. And he's like
horror movies in
the new phase of his. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I was like, wow, this is like Bradley Whitford circa, you know, West Wing or something, but a little bit older. And now he's like transitioned into new Bradley Whitford.
Yeah. People grow old, Matt. It happens.
No, but it's like, you know, some people, especially in Hollywood, might keep dyeing their hair. They might try to look the same. Now when I picture him, I think of him with not very men. White hair.
Yeah, I was going to say some hair. People. Do you mean women?
No, plenty of men do it. Have you seen the cast of Friends? I feel like the men as well. Like, it's not just women. In Hollywood, it's everyone, right? I mean, it's a good like.
Yeah, but men get a bonus 20 years.
There's a different, there's different pressure. I get that. But within Hollywood, I think it's not what the right word is, but. I mean, okay, I don't want to call anyone out, but there is, have you seen lately?
No.
Is that mean? He's
pretty old.
No, but he's clearly not trying. I perceive is he's trying not to look older, but he is getting older and he's taking steps to try to protect against that.
Who doesn't age is the new Morticia, Catherine Zeta-Jones.
That's because she's fab.
She's going to be Morticia in Tim Burton.
I know. That's so exciting. It's going to be a show. Is it going to be a show, right?
Yeah. I'm so excited for it. That'll be so cool.
That's so exciting.
Has a girlfriend who's apparently 26 years younger than him.
Ew. Okay. Well, that's my worst nightmare. That's it. Okay, Lena, what's your worst nightmare?
I'll be honest. My only reoccurring nightmare is being in a scary situation, being in a threatening situation, and not having a voice. It's like,
wow, way to be deep.
I know. Go ahead and like psychoanalyze me here, but I literally have nightmares where I'm screaming and no sound comes out, and that's the worst part of it.
Sorry, your audio's not working. I didn't catch that.
All right. Follow. Let's go. Bye.
Yeah, that was good.
I think that concludes Cabin in the Woods. Thank you, Lena, for being our very first guest. And make sure if you want to follow her and her journey and watching horror films, follow her at Let's Scare Lena. Is that correct?
Yep, Let's Scare Lena on Instagram. And then you can follow along with my reviews of the horror movies at scarelena.com. Thank you so much for having me, guys. This was so much fun.
Yeah, no, this was great. I'm excited to kick off Halloween season with this one.
The lambs have passed through the gate. They are come to the killing floor.
Well, you're doing a great job out there. By the numbers, man, you got to start it off just right. So we'll talk to you later, okay?
Their blind eyes see nothing of the horrors to come. Their ears are stopped.
They are the gods' fools.
Well, that's how it works.
Cleanse them. Cleanse the world of their ignorance and sin. Bathe them in the crimson of... Am I on speakerphone?